realization that he is becoming more and more dissatisfied with his life, empathy. Truth statements would communicate her unhappiness with their current situation and the crucial need to do something about it, such as enter therapy. It is also often helpful to be able to predict impulsive behaviors from past experiences. For example, after a period of sobriety, Phyllis might remind Larry in a neutral, matter-of-fact way that in the past, when things have gone well, he has built up pressures that have exploded into drinking binges. By pointing out previous patterns, one can help the borderline become more aware of feelings that preview the onset of impulsivity. This should be accompanied by support statements, so it is not interpreted as defeating, there you go again, criticism. In such a way, the borderline learns that behaviors that he has perceived as chaotic and unpredictable can actually be anticipated, understood, and thereby controlled. However, if the borderline does feel criticized, predicting can stimulate a contrariness that motivates him to not repeat destructive patterns just to show you. Finally, in therapy, Larry began to see that his seemingly unpredictable behaviors represented anger at himself and others. He realized how he would become abusive to his wife or begin drinking when frustrated with himself. This impulsive behavior would result in guilt and self-chastisement, which in turn served to expiate his sins. As Larry began to value himself more highly and respect his own ideals and beliefs, his destructive activities diminished. Understanding your own emotions. When you join the borderline on his roller coaster ride, you also must expect to experience a variety of emotions, especially guilt, fear, and anger. When self-destructive, the borderline may appear helpless and project responsibility for his behavior onto others, who may all too readily accept it. Guilt is a strong inhibitor of honest confrontation. Similarly, fear of physical harm to the borderline, others, or yourself, may also be a powerful deterrent to initiating interactions. Anger is a common reaction when, as frequently occurs, you feel manipulated or simply don't like or understand a certain behavior. Lois's mother called Lois frequently, complaining of severe headaches, loneliness, and an overall disgust with life. With her father long dead and her siblings estranged from the family, Lois was the good daughter, the only child who cared. Lois felt guilty when her mother was alone and in pain. Despite Lois's love for her mother and the feelings of guilt her mother triggered, Lois began feeling angry when she saw her mother becoming progressively more helpless and unwilling to take care of herself. Lois began to recognize that she was being taken advantage of by her mother's increasing dependency. But when Lois expressed her anger, her mother just became more tearful and helpless, and Lois felt more guilty, and the cycle repeated again. Only when Lois untangled herself from this interlocking system was her mother forced to achieve a healthier self-sufficiency. Special parenting problems. Most borderlines describe childhoods with characteristic features. Often, one parent was missing or frequently absent, had time-consuming outside interests, hobbies, or career demands, or abused alcohol or drugs. If both parents did live in the home, their relationship was often not harmonious. There was frequently a lack of consensus about child rearing, and subsequently one parent, usually the mother, assumed the primary parenting role. Such parents are rarely capable of presenting a united, collaborative front to their children. For such children, the world abounds with inconsistencies and invalidation. When the child requires structure, he receives contradictions. When he needs firmness, he gets ambivalence. Thus, the future borderline is deprived of the opportunity to develop a consistent core identity. The mother of a borderline may be blatantly ill, but more often her pathology is quite subtle. She may even be perceived by others as the perfect mother because of her total dedication to her children. Deeper observation, however, reveals her over-involvement in her children's lives, her encouragement of mutual dependencies, and her unwillingness to allow her children to mature and separate naturally. Attempting to maintain consistent child rearing after separation or divorce is especially challenging. Consistency may be difficult for the borderline parent who may consciously or unconsciously use the children to continue the battle with her spouse. The other parent should try to minimize conflicts by being highly selective in choosing one's battles. Trying to defend oneself or debate accusations will not alter the resentment and will only confuse the children. Often, the best approach is to redirect conversation away from the personal relationship. Try to get the spouse to focus only on what's best for the kids. Usually, common ground can be found and conflict can be minimized. Separations. Separations from parents, particularly during the first few years of life, are common in the borderline biography. On the surface, these separations may appear insignificant, yet they have profound effects. For example, the birth of a sibling takes the mother away from her normal activities for a few weeks, but when she returns, she's no longer as responsive to the older child. In the eyes of the older child, mother has disappeared, replaced by someone different, one who now has mothering duties with a younger sibling. For the healthy child, in a healthy environment, this trauma is easily overcome. But for the borderline, in a borderline setting, it may be one of a series of losses and perceived abandonments. Extended illnesses, frequent travels, divorce, or the death of a parent also deprive the developing infant of consistent mothering at crucial times, which may interfere with his abilities to develop trust and constancy in his unstable and unreliable world. The trauma of child abuse. Severe physical and/or sexual abuse is a common trauma in the history of the borderline personality. When a child is abused, he invariably blames himself because, consciously or subconsciously, that is the best of the available alternatives. If he blames the adult, he will be terrified by his dependency on incompetents who are unable to take care of him. If he blames no one, pain becomes random and unpredictable, and therefore even more frightening because he has no hope of controlling it. Blaming himself makes the abuse easier to understand and therefore possible to control. He can feel that he somehow causes the abuse and therefore will be able to find a way to end it, or he will give up and accept that he is bad. In these situations, the borderline learns early in life that he is bad, that he causes bad things to happen. He begins to expect punishment and may only feel secure when being punished. Later, self-mutilation may sometimes be the borderline's way of perpetuating this familiar, secure feeling of being chastised. He may see abuse as a kind of love and repeat the abuse with his own children. As an adult, he remains locked in the child's confusing world in which love and hate co-mingle. Only good and bad exist with no in-between, and only inconsistency is consistent. Abuse can take subtler forms than physical violence or deviant sexuality. Emotional abuse, expressed as verbal harassment, sarcasm, humiliation, or frigid silence, can be equally devastating. Stephanie could never please her father. When she was young, he called her chubby and laughed at her clumsy tomboy attempts to please him by playing sports. She was stupid when her grades were less than perfect and when she broke dishes while trying to clear the kitchen. He ridiculed her strapless gown on prom night and on graduation day insisted that she would amount to nothing. As an adult, Stephanie was always unsure of herself, never trusting flattering comments and hopelessly trying to please people who were impossible to please. After a long string of destructive relationships, Stephanie finally met Ted, who seemed caring and supportive. At every turn, however, Stephanie tried to sabotage the relationship by constantly testing his loyalty and questioning his commitment, convinced that no one whom she valued could value her. Ted needed to understand Stephanie's background and recognize that trust could not realistically be established except over long periods of time. Not everyone is willing to wait. Ted was. Recognizing BPD in adolescence. By definition, the struggles of adolescence and BPD are very similar. both the normal adolescent and the borderline struggle for individuality and separation from parents, seek bonds with friends and identification with groups, try to avoid being alone, tend to go through dramatic mood changes, and are generally prone to impulsivity. The teenager's easy distractibility is analogous to the borderline's difficulty to commit himself to a goal and follow through. Adolescents' eccentric dress styles, prehistoric eating habits, and piercing music are usually attempts to carve out a distinctive identity and relate to specific groups of peers, efforts similar to those of borderlines. A normal adolescent may listen to gloomy music, write pessimistic poetry, glorify suicidal celebrities, dramatically scream, cry, and threaten. However, the normal adolescent does not cut his wrists, binge and purge several times a day, become addicted to drugs, or attack his mother. And it is these extremes that anticipate the development of BPD. Some parents will deny the seriousness of an adolescent's problems, a drug overdose, for example, by dismissing them as a typical teenager's bid for attention. Though it is true that children often seek attention in dramatic ways, neither suicide attempts nor any destructive behaviors are normal. They instead suggest the possibility of incipient borderline personality or another disorder and should be evaluated by a professional. Compared to teenagers with other psychiatric disorders, borderline adolescents experience some of the most severe pathology and dysfunction. Borderline adolescents exhibit higher lifetime rates of sexually transmitted infections and medical problems. They are more likely to abuse alcohol, cigarettes, and other drugs. Usually others, parents, teachers, employers, friends, will recognize when the normal teenager crosses the border into borderline behavior even before the adolescent himself. Continuous drug abuse, serial tumultuous relationships, or anorexic fasting are reliable indicators that deeper problems may be involved. The teen's whole style of functioning should be the focus of examination rather than individual symptoms. This is especially crucial when considering the potential for suicide. Suicide is a leading cause of death among teenagers and is particularly prevalent in children who are depressed, abuse drugs, act impulsively or violently, and maintain few support systems, all prominent features of BPD. Threats of self-harm should always be taken seriously. Attempts to self-mutilate or harm oneself only for attention can go tragically awry. Parents who try to distinguish real suicide from attention-seeking miss the point. Both are seriously pathological behaviors and require treatment, often hospitalization. Working with the borderline. In the work environment, borderlines are often perceived as strange or eccentric. They may tend to isolate themselves, avoid personal contacts, and keep others away with an aura of surliness, suspicion, or eccentricity. Some habitually complain of physical ailments or personal problems and occasionally have fits of paranoia and rage. Some others may act perfectly normal in the work situation but appear awkward or uncomfortable around coworkers outside the workplace. Many employers have implemented employee assistance programs, EAPs, in-house counselors, and referral departments initially designed to help employees deal with alcohol and drug abuse problems. Today, many EAPs are also available to help workers confront other emotional problems as well as legal and financial difficulties. Many EAP counselors are well equipped to identify features of alcohol or drug abuse or of prominent psychiatric illnesses such as depression or psychosis, but they may be less familiar with the more intricate symptoms of BPD. Though the employee's supervisor, coworkers, counselor, even the employee himself may be aware of some dysfunctional or disruptive behaviors, the borderline might not be referred for treatment because his behaviors cannot be clearly associated with a more commonly recognized disorder. The prospective employer may suspect borderline characteristics in an applicant who has a history of frequent job changes. These terminations will often be explained by personality conflicts, which indeed is often accurate. Other job separations may be sparked by a significant change, a new supervisor, new computer system, or an adjustment in job description that disrupted a very structured, perhaps even monotonous, routine. Because the borderline may be very creative and dedicated, he can be a most valuable employee. When functioning on a higher level, he can be colorful, stimulating, and inspiring to others. Most borderlines function optimally in a well-defined, structured environment in which expectations are clearly delineated. Coworkers will be most comfortable with the borderline when they recognize his tendency to see the world as black or white and accept his need for well-defined structure. They should avoid kidding around with him and stay away from good-natured mocking, which the borderline may often misconstrue. It may be helpful to intercede if the borderline becomes the target of others' jokes. Frequent compliments for good work and matter-of-fact, non-condemning recognition of mistakes with suggestions for improvement can aid the borderline's functioning in the workplace. Similarly, when the borderline is in an executive position, it is important for employees to recognize and learn to deal with his black or white thinking. Employees should learn to expect and accept his changeability with a minimum of hurt feelings. They should avoid entanglement in logical arguments because consistency may not always be possible for the borderline. They should look for allies elsewhere in the organization to provide reliable feedback and evaluations. Playing with the borderline. At play, the borderline is typically unpredictable and sometimes very disconcerting. He may have great difficulty with recreation and play with a seriousness that is out of proportion to the relaxed nature of the activity. He may be your newly assigned tennis doubles partner who at first seems nice enough, but as the game goes on becomes increasingly frustrated and angry. Though you continually remind him that it's just a game, he may stomp around, curse himself, throw the racket, and swear to give up the sport. He may be your son's little league coach who works well with the kids, but suddenly becomes wildly abusive to the teenage umpire, or angrily humiliating to his own son, seen as an extension of himself, who strikes out with the bases loaded. Although these examples may describe borderline-like traits in some people who in fact are not borderline, when these behaviors are extreme or represent a consistent pattern, they may be indications of a true borderline personality. The borderline's intensity interferes with his ability to relax and have fun. Others' attempts at humor may frustrate him and make him angry. It is virtually impossible to kid him out of it. If you elect to continue playing tennis with your borderline partner, judicious use of setup principles may make the experience more tolerable. The maturing borderline. Higher-functioning adult borderlines who do not fully recover may still have successful careers, assume traditional family roles, and have a cadre of friends and support systems. They may live generally satisfactory lives within their own separate corner of existence, despite recurrent frustrations with themselves and others who inhabit that niche. Lower-functioning borderlines, however, have more difficulty maintaining a job and friends and may lack family and support systems. They may inhabit lonelier and more desperate black holes within their own personal universe. Common to most borderlines is an element of unpredictability and erratic behavior. It may be more obvious in the lonely, isolated individual, but those who know the contented family man well can also detect inconsistencies in his behavior that belie the superficial rationality. At work, even the borderline who is a successful businessman or professional may be known by those working closely with him to be a bit strange, even if they can't quite localize what it is that projects that aura of imbalance. As many borderlines grow older, they may mellow out. Impulsivity, mood swings, and self-destructive behaviors seem to diminish in dramatic intensity. This pattern might be an objective reflection of change or a subjective evaluation of those living or working with the borderline. The borderline's friends and lovers may have adjusted to his erratic actions over time and no longer notice or respond to the outrageousness. Maybe it is because he has settled into a more routine lifestyle that no longer requires periodic outbursts, drinking binges, suicide threats, or other dramatic gestures to achieve his needs. Perhaps with age, the borderline loses the energy or stamina to maintain the frenetic pace of borderline living. Or perhaps there is simply a natural healing process that takes place for some borderlines as they mature. In any event, most borderlines get better over time, with or without treatment. Indeed, most could be considered cured in the sense that they no longer fulfill 5 of the 9 defining criteria. Long-term prognosis for this devastating disease is very hopeful. Thus, those sharing life with the borderline can expect his behaviors over time to become more tolerable. At this point, the unpredictable reactions become more predictable and therefore easier to manage, and it becomes possible for the borderline to learn how to love and be loved in a healthier fashion. Chapter 7. Seeking Therapy. I'm going to give him one more year, and then I'm going to Lourdes. From Annie Hall by Woody Allen, about his psychiatrist. Dr. Smith, a nationally known psychiatrist, had called me about his niece. She was depressed and in need of a good psychotherapist. He was calling to say that he had recommended me. Arranging an appointment was difficult. She could not rearrange her schedule to fit my openings, so I juggled and rearranged my schedule to fit hers. I felt pressure to be accommodating and brilliant, so that Dr. Smith's faith in me would be justified. I had just opened my practice and needed some validation of my professional skills, yet I knew that these feelings were a bad sign. I was nervous. Julie was strikingly attractive. Tall and blonde, she easily could have been a model. A law student, she was 25, bright and articulate. She arrived 10 minutes late and neither apologized for nor even acknowledged this slight on her part. When I looked closely, I could see that her eye makeup was a little too heavy, as if she were trying to conceal a sadness and exhaustion inside. Julie was an only child, very dependent on her successful parents who were always traveling. Because she couldn't stand being alone, she cruised through a series of affairs. When a man would break off the relationship, she'd become extremely depressed until embarking on the next affair. She was now between relationships. Her most recent man had left her, and there was no one to replace him. It wasn't long before her treatment fell into a routine. As a session would near its end, she'd always bring up something important, so our appointments would end a little late. The phone calls between sessions became more frequent and lasted longer. Over the next 6 weeks, we met once a week, but then mutually agreed to increase the frequency to twice a week. She talked about her loneliness and her difficulties with separations, but continued to feel hopeless and alone. She told me that she often exploded in rage against her friends, though these outbursts were hard for me to imagine because she was so demure in my office. She had problems sleeping, her appetite decreased, and she was losing weight. She began to talk about suicide. I prescribed antidepressant medications for her, but she felt even more depressed and was unable to concentrate in school. Finally, after 3 months of treatment, she reported increasing suicidal thoughts and began to visualize hanging herself. I recommended hospitalization, which she reluctantly accepted. Clearly, more intense work was needed to deal with this unremitting depression. The first time I saw the anger was the day of her admission, when Julie was describing her decision to come to the hospital. Crying softly, she spoke of the fear she had experienced when explaining her hospitalization to her father. Then suddenly, her face hardened, and she said, "Do you know what that bitch did?" A moment passed before I realized that Julie was now referring to Irene, the nurse who had admitted her to the unit. Furiously, Julie described the nurse's lack of attention, her awkwardness with the blood pressure cuff, and a mix-up with a lunch tray. Her ethereal beauty mutated into a face of rage and terror. I jumped when she pounded the table. After a few days, Julie was galvanizing the hospital unit with her demands and tirades. Some of the nurses and patients tried to calm and placate her. Others bristled when she threw tantrums and objects and walked out of group sessions. "Do you know what your patient did this morning, doctor?" asked one nurse as I stepped onto the floor. The emphasis was clearly on the "your," as if I were responsible for Julie's behavior and deserved the staff's reprimands for not controlling her. "You're overprotective. She's manipulating you. She needs to be confronted." I immediately came to my own and Julie's defense. She needs support and caring, I replied. She needs to be reparented. She needs to learn trust. How dare they question my judgment? Do I dare question it? Throughout the first few days, Julie complained about the nurses, the other patients, the other doctors. She said I was understanding and caring, and I had much greater insight and knowledge than the other therapists she had seen. After 3 days, Julie insisted on discharge. The nurses were skeptical. They didn't know her well enough. She hadn't talked much about herself either to them or in group therapy. She was talking only to her doctor, but she insisted her suicidal thoughts had dissipated and she needed to get back to her life. In the end, I authorized the discharge. The next day, she wobbled into the emergency room drunk, with cuts on her wrist. I had no choice but to readmit her to the ward. Though the nurses never actually said, "I told you so," their haughty looks were unmistakable and insufferable. I began to avoid them even more than I had until that point. I resumed Julie's therapy on an individual basis and dropped her from group sessions. 2 days later, she demanded discharge. When I turned down the request, she exploded. "I thought you trusted me," she said. "I thought you understood me. All you care about is power. You just love to control people." Maybe she's right, I thought. Perhaps I am too controlling, too insecure. Or was she just attacking my vulnerability, my need to be perceived as caring and trusting? Was she just stoking my guilt and masochism? Was she the victim here, or was I? "I thought you were different," she said. "I thought you were special. I thought you really cared." The problem was, I thought so too. By the end of the week, the insurance company was calling me daily, questioning her continued stay. Nursing notes recorded her insistence that she was no longer self-destructive, and she continued to lobby for discharge. We agreed to dismiss her from the hospital, but have her continue in the day hospital program, in which she could attend the hospital scheduled groups during the day and go home in the afternoon. On her second day in the outpatient program, she arrived late, disheveled, and hungover. She tearfully related the previous night's sleazy encounter with a stranger in a bar. The situation was becoming clearer to me. She was begging for limits and controls and structure, but couldn't acknowledge this dependency. So she acted outrageously to make controls necessary and then got angry and denied her desire for them. I could see this, but she couldn't. Gradually, I stopped looking forward to seeing her. At each session, I was reminded of my failure, and I found myself wishing that she would either get well or disappear. When she told me that maybe her old roommate's doctor would be better for her, I interpreted this as a wish to run away from herself and the real issues she faced. A change at this point would be counterproductive for her, I knew, but silently I hoped that she would change doctors for my sake. She still talked of killing herself, and I guiltily fantasized that it would be almost a relief for me if she did. Her changes had changed me, from a masochist to a sadist. During her third week in the day hospital, another patient hanged himself while home over the weekend. Frightened, Julie flew into a rage. "Why didn't you and these nurses know he was going to kill himself?" she screamed. "How could you let him do it? Why didn't you protect him?" Julie was devastated. Who was going to protect her? Who would make the pain go away? I finally realized that it would have to be Julie. No one else lived inside her skin. No one else could totally understand and protect her. It was starting to make some sense, to me, and after a while, to Julie. She could see that no matter how hard she tried to run away from her feelings, she could not escape being herself. Even though she wanted to run away from the bad person she thought she was, she had to learn to accept herself, flaws and all. Ultimately, she would see that just being Julie was okay. Julie's anger at the staff gradually migrated toward the suicide patient, who didn't give himself a chance. When she saw his responsibility, she began to see hers. She discovered that people who really cared about her did not let her do whatever she wanted, as her parents had done. Sometimes caring meant setting limits. Sometimes it meant telling her what she didn't want to hear. And sometimes it meant reminding her of her accountability to herself. It wasn't much longer before all of us, Julie, the staff, and I, began working together. I stopped trying so hard to be likable, wise, and unerring. It was more important to be consistent and reliable, to be there. After several weeks, Julie left the hospital outpatient program and returned to our office therapy. She was still lonely and afraid, but she didn't need to hurt herself anymore. Even more important, she was accepting the fact that she could survive loneliness and fear, but could still care about herself. After a while, Julie found a new man who really seemed to care about her. As for me, I learned some of the same things Julie did, that distasteful emotions determine who I am to a great extent, and that accepting these unpleasant parts of myself helps me to better understand my patients. Beginning treatment. Therapists who treat borderline personality often find that the rigors of treatment place a great strain on their professional abilities, as well as on their patients. Treatment sessions may be stormy, frustrating, and unpredictable. The treatment period proceeds at a snail-like pace and may require years to achieve true change. Many borderline patients drop out of therapy in the first few months. Treatment is so difficult because the borderline responds to it in much the same way as to other personal relationships. The borderline will see the therapist as caring and gentle one moment, deceitful and intimidating the next. In therapy, the borderline can be extremely demanding, dependent, and manipulative. It is not uncommon for a borderline patient to telephone incessantly between sessions and then appear unexpectedly in the therapist's office, threatening bodily harm to himself unless the therapist meets with him immediately. Angry tirades against the therapist and the process of therapy are common. Often, the borderline can be very perceptive about the sensitivity of the therapist and eventually goad him into anger, frustration, self-doubt, and hopelessness. Given the wide range of possible contributing causes of BPD and the extremes of behavior involved, there is a predictably wide range of treatment methods. According to the American Psychiatric Association's practice guideline for the treatment of patients with borderline personality disorder, the primary treatment for borderline personality disorder is psychotherapy, complemented by symptom-targeted pharmacotherapy. Psychotherapy can take place in individual, group, or family therapy settings. It can proceed in or out of a hospital setting. Therapy approaches can be combined, such as individual and group. Some therapy approaches are more psychodynamic, that is, emphasize the connection between past experiences and unconscious feelings with current behaviors. Other approaches are more cognitive and directive, focused more on changing current behaviors than necessarily exploring unconscious motivations. Some therapies are time-limited, but most are open-ended. Some treatments are usually avoided. Strict behavior modification is seldom utilized. Classical psychoanalysis on the couch with use of free association in an unstructured environment can be devastating for the borderline, whose primitive defenses may be overwhelmed. Because hypnosis can produce an unfamiliar trance state resulting in panic or even psychosis, it is also usually avoided as a therapeutic technique. Goals of therapy. All treatment approaches strive for a common goal: more effective functioning in a world that is experienced as less mystifying, less harmful, and more pleasurable. The process usually involves developing insight into the unproductiveness of current behaviors. This is the easy part. More difficult is the process of reworking old reflexes and developing new ways of dealing with life's stresses. The most important part of any therapy is the relationship between the patient and therapist. This interaction forms the foundation for trust, object constancy, and emotional intimacy. The therapist must become a trusted figure, a mirror to reflect a developing consistent identity. Starting with this relationship, the borderline learns to extend to others appropriate expectations and trust. The primary goal of the therapist is to work toward losing, not keeping, his patient. This is accomplished by directing the patient's attention to certain areas for examination, not by controlling him. Though the therapist serves as the navigator, pointing out landscapes of interest and helping to reroute the itinerary around storm conditions, it is the patient who must remain firmly in the pilot's seat. Family and loved ones are also sometimes included on this journey. A major objective is for the patient to return home and improve relationships, not to abandon them. Some people are fearful of psychiatry and psychotherapy, perceiving the process as a form of mind control or behavior modification perpetrated on helpless, dependent patients who are molded into robots by bearded Svengali-like mesmerists. The aim of psychotherapy is to help a patient individuate and achieve more freedom and personal dignity. Unfortunately, just as some people erroneously believe that you can be hypnotized against your will, so some believe that you can be therapized against your will. Popular culture, especially cinema, frequently portrays the shrink as either a bumbling fool more in need of treatment than his patients, or a nefarious, brilliant criminal. Such irrational fears may deprive people of opportunities to escape self-imposed captivity and achieve self-acceptance. Length of therapy. Because of the past prominence of psychoanalysis, which characteristically requires several years of intensive, frequent treatment, most people view any form of psychotherapy as being extended and drawn out, and therefore very expensive. The addition of medications and specialized treatments to the therapeutic armamentarium are responses to the need for practical and affordable treatment methods. Broken bones heal and infections clear up, but scars on the psyche may require longer treatment. If therapy terminates quickly, one may question if it was too superficial. If it extends for many years, one may wonder if it is merely intellectual game playing that enriches psychotherapists while financially enslaving their dependent and helpless patients. How long should therapy last? The answer depends on the specific goals. Resolution of specific targeted symptoms, such as depression, severe anxiety, or temper outbursts, may be accomplished in relatively brief time spans, such as weeks or months. If the goal is more profound restructuring, a longer duration will be required. Over time, BPD is usually cured. This means that the patient, by strict definition, no longer exhibits 5 of the 9 defining DSM-4 criteria. However, some individuals may continue to suffer from disabling symptoms, which can require continued treatment. Therapy may be interrupted. It is not unusual for borderlines to engage in several separate rounds of therapy with different therapists and different techniques. Breaks in therapy may be useful to solidify ideas, or to try out new insights, or merely to catch up with life and allow time to grow and mature. Financial limitations, significant life changes, or just a need for a respite from the intensity of treatment may mandate a time out. Sometimes, years of therapy may be necessary to achieve substantive changes in functioning. When the changes come slowly, it can be difficult to determine whether more work should proceed or if this is as good as it gets. The therapist must consider both the borderline's propensity to run from confrontations with his unhealthy behaviors and his tendency to cling dependently to the therapist and others. For some borderlines, therapy may never formally end. They may derive great benefit from continuing intermittent contacts with a trusted therapist. Such arrangements would be considered refueling stops on the road to greater independence, providing the patient does not rely on these contacts to drive his life. How psychotherapy works. As we shall see later in this and the next chapter, there are several established therapeutic approaches for the treatment of BPD. They may proceed in individual, group, or family settings. Most of these are derived from two primary orientations: psychodynamic psychotherapy and cognitive behavioral therapy. In the former, discussion of the past and present are utilized to discover patterns that may forge a more productive future. This form of therapy is more intensive, with sessions conducted several times a week and usually continuing for a longer period. Effective therapy must employ a structured, consistent format with clear goals. Yet there must also be flexibility to adapt to changing needs. Cognitive behavioral approaches focus on changing current thinking processes and repetitive behaviors that are disabling. This type of therapy is less concerned about the past. Treatment is more problem-focused and often time-limited. Some therapy programs combine both orientations. Whatever the structure, the therapist tries to guide clients to examine their experience and serves as a touchstone for experimenting with new behaviors. Ultimately, the patient begins to accept his own choices in life and to change his self-image as a helpless pawn moved by forces beyond his control. Much of this process emerges from the primary relationship between therapist and patient. Often, in any therapy, both develop intense feelings, called transference and countertransference. Transference. Transference refers to the patient's unrealistic projections onto the therapist of feelings and attitudes previously experienced from other important persons in the patient's life. For example, a patient may get very angry with the doctor, based not on the doctor's communications, but on feelings that the doctor is much like his mother, who in the past elicited much anger from him. Or, a patient may feel she has fallen in love with her therapist, who represents a fantasied, all-powerful, protective father figure. By itself, transference is neither negative nor positive, but it is always a distortion, a projection of past emotions onto current objects. Borderline transference is likely to be extremely inconsistent, just like other aspects of the patient's life. The borderline will see the therapist as caring, capable, and honest one moment, deceitful, devious, and unfeeling the next. These distortions make the establishment of an alliance with the therapist more difficult. Yet, establishing and sustaining this alliance is the most important part of any treatment. In the beginning stages of therapy, the borderline both craves and fears closeness to the therapist. He wants to be taken care of, but fears being overwhelmed and controlled. He attempts to seduce the doctor into taking care of him and rebels against his attempts to control his life. As the therapist remains steadfast and consistent in withstanding his tirades, object constancy develops. The borderline begins to trust that the therapist will not abandon him. From this beachhead of trust, the borderline can venture out with new relationships and establish more trusting contacts. Initially, however, such new friendships can be difficult to sustain for the borderline, who in the past may have perceived his formation of new alliances as a form of disloyalty. He may even fear that his mate, friend, or therapist may become jealous and enraged if he broadens his social contacts. As the borderline progresses, he settles into a more comfortable, trusting dependency. As he prepares for termination, however, there may again be a resurgence of turmoil in the relationship. He may pine for his previous ways of functioning and resent needing to proceed onward. He may feel like a tiring swimmer who realizes he has already swum more than halfway across the lake and now, rather than return to the shore, must continue on to the other side before resting. At this point, the borderline must also deal with his separateness and recognize that he, not the therapist, has effected change. Like Dumbo, who first attributes his flying ability to his magic feather, but then realizes it is due to his own talents, the borderline must begin to recognize and accept his own abilities to function independently, and he must develop new coping mechanisms to replace the ones that no longer work. As the borderline improves, the intensity of the transference diminishes. The anger, impulsive behaviors, and mood changes, often directed at or for the benefit of the therapist, become less severe. Panicky dependency may gradually wither and be replaced by a growing self-confidence. Anger erupts less often, replaced by greater determination to be in charge of one's own life. Impatience and caprice diminish because the borderline begins to develop a separate sense of identity that can evolve without the need for parasitic attachment. Countertransference. Countertransference refers to the therapist's own emotional reactions to the patient, which are based less on realistic considerations than on the therapist's past experiences and needs. An example is the doctor who perceives the patient as more needy and helpless than is truly the case, because of the doctor's need to be a caretaker, to perceive himself as compassionate, and to avoid confrontation. The borderline is often very perceptive about others, including the therapist. This sensitivity often provokes the therapist's own unresolved feelings. The doctor's needs for appreciation, affection, and control can sometimes prompt him into inappropriate behavior. He may be overly protective of the patient and encourage dependency. He may be overly controlling, demanding that the patient carry out his recommendations. He may complain of his own problems and induce the patient to take care of him. He may extract information from the patient for financial gain or mere titillation. He may even enter into a sexual relationship with the patient to teach intimacy. The therapist may rationalize all these as necessary for a very sick patient, but in reality, they are satisfying his own needs. It is these countertransference feelings that result in most examples of unethical behavior between a trusted doctor or therapist and patient. The borderline can provoke feelings of anger, frustration, self-doubt, and hopelessness in the therapist that mirror his own. Goaded into emotions that challenge his professional self-worth, the therapist may experience genuine countertransference hate for the patient and view him as untreatable. Treatment of the borderline personality can be so infuriating that the term borderline has been inaccurately used sometimes by professionals as a derogatory label for any patient who is extremely irritating or who does not respond well to therapy. In these cases, borderline more accurately reflects the countertransference frustration of a therapist than a scientific diagnosis of his patient. The patient-therapist fit. All of the treatments described in this audiobook can be productive approaches to the borderline patient, though no therapeutic techniques have been shown to be uniformly curative in all cases. The only factor that seems to correlate consistently with improvement is a positive, mutually respectful relationship between patient and therapist. Even when a doctor is successful in treating one or many borderline patients, this does not guarantee automatic success in treating others. The primary determining factor of success is usually a positive, optimistic feeling shared between the participants, a kind of patient-therapist fit. A good fit is difficult to define precisely, but refers to the abilities of both the patient and therapist to tolerate the predictable turbulence of therapy while maintaining a sturdy alliance as therapy proceeds. The therapist's role. Because treatment of BPD may entail a combination of several therapies, individual, group, and family psychotherapies, medications, and hospitalization, the therapist's role in treatment may be as varied as the different therapies available. The doctor may be confrontational or non-directive. He may either spontaneously exhort and suggest or initiate fewer exchanges and expect the patient to assume a heavier burden for the therapy process. More important than the particular doctor or treatment method is the feeling of comfort and trust experienced by both patient and therapist. Both must perceive commitment, reliability, and true partnership from the other. To achieve this feeling of mutual comfort, both patient and doctor must understand and share common objectives. They should agree upon methods and have compatible styles. Most important, the therapist must recognize when he is treating a borderline patient. The therapist should suspect that he is dealing with BPD when he takes on a patient whose past psychiatric history includes contradictory diagnoses, multiple past hospitalizations, or trials of many medications. The patient may report being kicked out of previous therapies and becoming persona non grata in the local emergency room, having frequented the ER enough times to have earned a nickname, such as Overdose Eddie, from the medical staff. The experienced doctor will also be able to trust his countertransference reactions to the patient. Borderlines usually elicit very strong emotional reactions from others, including therapists. If early on in the evaluation, the therapist experiences strong feelings of wanting to protect or rescue the patient, of responsibility for the patient, or of extreme anger toward the patient, he should recognize that his intense responses may signify reactions to a borderline personality. Choosing a therapist. Therapists with differing styles may perform equally well with borderlines. Conversely, doctors who possess special expertise or interest in BPD and who generally do well with borderline patients cannot guarantee success with every patient. A patient can choose from a variety of mental health professionals, though psychiatrists following their medical training have years of exposure to psychotherapy techniques, and as physicians are the only professionals capable of dealing with concurrent medical illnesses, prescribing medications, and arranging hospitalization, other skilled professionals, psychologists, social workers, counselors, psychiatric nurse clinicians, may also attain expertise in psychotherapy with borderline patients. In general, a therapist who works well with BPD possesses certain qualities that a prospective patient can usually recognize. He should be experienced in the treatment of BPD and remain tolerant and accepting in order to help the patient develop object constancy. He should be flexible and innovative in order to adapt to the contortions through which therapy with a borderline may twist him. He should possess a sense of humor, or at least a clear sense of proportion, to present an appropriate model for the patient and to protect himself from the relentless intensity that such therapy requires. Just as the doctor evaluates the patient during the initial assessment interviews, so should the patient evaluate the doctor to determine if they can work together effectively. First, the patient should consider whether he is comfortable with the therapist's personality and style. Will he be able to talk with him openly and candidly? Is he too intimidating, too pushy, too wimpy, too seductive? Secondly, do the therapist's assessment and goals coincide with the patient's? Treatment should be a collaboration in which both parties share the same view and use the same language. What should therapy hope to achieve? How will you know when you get there? About how long should it take? Finally, are the recommended methods acceptable to the patient? There should be agreement on the type of psychotherapy advocated and the suggested frequency of meetings. Will the doctor and patient meet individually or together with others? Will there be a combination of approaches, which might include, say, individual therapy on a weekly basis, along with intermittent conjoint meetings with the spouse? Will therapy be more exploratory or more supportive? Will medications or hospitalization likely be employed? What kinds of medicines and which hospitals? This initial assessment period usually requires at least one interview, often more. Both the patient and the doctor should be evaluating their ability and willingness to work with the other. Such an evaluation should be recognized as a kind of no-fault interchange. It is irrelevant and probably impossible to blame the therapist or the patient for the inability to establish rapport. It is necessary only to determine whether a therapeutic alliance is possible. However, if a patient continues to find every psychotherapist he interviews unacceptable, his commitment to treatment should be questioned. Perhaps he is searching for the perfect doctor who will take care of him, or whom he can manipulate. Or he should consider the possibility that he is merely avoiding therapy, and should perhaps choose an admittedly imperfect doctor and get on with the task of getting better. Obtaining a second opinion. Once therapy is underway, it is not unusual for treatment to stop and start, or for the form of therapy to change over time. Adjustments may be necessary because the borderline may require changes in his treatment as he progresses. Sometimes, however, it is difficult to distinguish when therapy is stuck from when it is working through painful issues. It is sometimes difficult to separate dependency and fear of moving on from the agonizing realization of unfinished business. At such times, there will arise a question of whether to proceed along the same lines or to take a step back and regroup. Should treatment begin to involve family members? Should group therapy be considered? Should therapist and patient reevaluate medications? At this point, a consultation with another doctor may be indicated. Often, the treating therapist will suggest this, but sometimes the patient must consider this option on his own. Although the patient may fear that a doctor is offended by a request for a second opinion, a competent and confident therapist would not object to or be defensive about such a request. It is, however, an area for exploration in the therapy itself in order to assess whether the patient's wish for a second evaluation might constitute a running away from difficult issues, or represent an unconscious, angry rebuke. A second opinion may be helpful for both the patient and the doctor in providing a fresh outlook on the progress of treatment. Getting the most from therapy. Appreciating treatment as a collaborative alliance is the most important step in maximizing therapy. The borderline frequently loses sight of this primary principle. Instead, she sometimes approaches treatment as if the purpose were to please the doctor or to fight with him, to be taken care of, or to pretend to have no problems. Some patients look at therapy as the opportunity to get away, get even, or get an ally. But the real goal of treatment should be to get better. The borderline may need to be frequently reminded of the parameters of therapy. He should understand the ground rules, including the doctor's availability and limitations, the time and resource constraints, and the agreed-upon mutual goals. The patient must not lose sight of the fact that he is bravely committing himself, his time, and his resources to the frightening task of trying to understand himself better and to effect alterations in his life pattern. Honesty in therapy is therefore of paramount importance for the patient's sake. He must not conceal painful areas or play games with the therapist to whom he has entrusted his care. He should abandon his need to control or wish to be liked by the therapist. In the borderline's quest to satisfy a presumed role, he may lose sight of the fact that it is not his obligation to please the therapist, but to work with him as a partner. Most important, the patient should always feel that he is actively collaborating in his treatment. He should avoid either the extreme of assuming a totally passive role, deferring completely to the doctor, or that of becoming a competitive, contentious rival, unwilling to listen to contributions from the therapist. Molding a viable relationship with the therapist becomes the borderline's first and, initially, most important task in embarking on a journey toward mental health. Therapeutic approaches. Many clinicians divide therapy orientations into exploratory and supportive treatments. Though both styles overlap, they are distinguished by the intensity of therapy and the techniques utilized. As we will see in the next chapter, a number of therapy strategies are used for the treatment of BPD. Some employ one style or the other, some combine elements of both. Exploratory therapy. Exploratory psychotherapy is a modification of classical psychoanalysis. Sessions are usually conducted two or more times per week. This form of therapy is more intensive than supportive therapy and has a more ambitious goal: to alter personality structure. The therapist provides little direct guidance to the patient, utilizing confrontation instead to point out the destructiveness of specific behaviors and to interpret unconscious precedents in the hopes of eradicating them. As in less intensive forms of therapy, a primary focus is on here and now issues. Genetic reconstruction, with its concentration on childhood and developmental issues, is important, but emphasized less than in classical psychoanalysis. The major goals in the early overlapping stages of treatment are to diminish behaviors that are self-destructive and disruptive to the treatment process, including prematurely terminating therapy, to solidify the patient's commitment to change, and to establish a trusting, reliable relationship between patient and doctor. Later stages emphasize the processes of formulating a separate, self-accepting sense of identity, establishing constant and trusting relationships, and tolerating aloneness and separations, including those from the therapist, adaptively. Transference in exploratory therapy is more intense and prominent than in supportive therapy. Dependency on the therapist, together with idealization and devaluation, are experienced more passionately as in classical psychoanalysis. Supportive therapy. Supportive psychotherapy is usually conducted on a once-weekly basis. Direct advice, education, and reassurance replace the confrontation and interpretation of unconscious material typically used in exploratory therapy. This approach is meant to be less intense and to bolster more adaptive defenses than exploratory therapy. In supportive psychotherapy, the doctor may reinforce suppression, discouraging discussion of painful memories that cannot be resolved. Rather than question the roots of minor obsessive concerns, the therapist may encourage them as hobbies or minor eccentricities. For example, a patient's need to keep his apartment spotless may not be dissected as to causes, but be acknowledged as a useful means to retain a sense of mastery and control when feeling overwhelmed. This contrasts with psychoanalysis, in which the aim is to analyze defenses and then eradicate them. Focusing on current, more practical issues, supportive therapy tries to quash suicidal and other self-destructive behaviors rather than to explore them fully. Impulsive actions and chaotic interpersonal relationships are identified and confronted without necessarily acquiring insight into the underlying factors that caused them. Supportive therapy may continue on a regular basis for some time before dwindling to an as-needed frequency. Intermittent contacts may continue indefinitely, and the therapist's continued availability may be very important. Therapy gradually terminates when other lasting relationships form and gratifying activities become more important in the patient's life. In supportive therapy, the patient tends to be less dependent on the therapist and to form a less intense transference. Though some clinicians argue that this form of therapy is less likely to institute lasting change in borderline patients, others have induced significant behavioral modifications in borderline patients with this kind of treatment. Group therapies. Treating the borderline in a group makes perfect sense. A group allows the borderline patient to dilute the intensity of feelings directed toward one individual, such as the therapist, by recognizing emotions stimulated by others. In a group, the borderline can more easily control the constant struggle between emotional closeness and distance, unlike individual therapy, in which the spotlight is always on him. The borderline can attract or avoid attention in a group. Confrontations by other group members may sometimes be more readily accepted than those from the idealized or devalued therapist, because a peer may be perceived as someone who really understands what I'm going through. The borderline's demanding nature, egocentrism, isolating withdrawal, abrasiveness, and social deviance can all be more effectively challenged by group peers. In addition, the borderline may accept more readily the group's expressions of hope, caring, and altruism. The progress of other group members can serve as a model for growth. When a group patient attains a goal, he serves as an inspiration to others in the group who have observed his growth and have vicariously shared his successes. The rivalry and competition so characteristic of borderline relationships are vividly demonstrated within the group setting and can be identified and addressed in ways that would be inaccessible in individual therapy. In a mixed group, that is, one containing lower and higher functioning borderlines or non-borderlines, all participants may benefit. Healthier patients can serve as models for more adaptive ways of functioning, and for those who have difficulty expressing emotion, the borderline can reciprocate by demonstrating greater access to emotion. Finally, a group provides a living, breathing experimental laboratory in which the borderline can attempt different patterns of behavior with other people without the risk of penalties from the outside world. However, the features that make group therapy a potentially attractive treatment for borderlines are the very reasons many such patients resist group settings. The demand for individual attention, the envy and distrust of others, the contradictory wish for and fear of intense closeness, all contribute to the reluctance of many borderline patients to enter group treatment. Higher functioning borderlines can tolerate these frustrations of group therapy and use the in vivo experiences to address defects in interrelating. Lower functioning borderlines, however, often will not join, and if they do, will not stay. The borderline patient may experience significant obstacles in psychodynamic group therapy. His self-absorption and lack of empathy often prevent involvement with others' problems. If the borderline's concerns are too deviant or the material too intense, he may feel isolated and disconnected. For example, a patient who discusses childhood incest or deviant sexual practices, or severe chemical abuse may fear that he may shock the other group members, and indeed some members may have difficulty relating to upsetting material. Some borderlines may share the feeling that their needs are not being met by the therapist. In such situations, they may attempt to take care of each other in the ways that they fantasized they could be cared for. This may lead to contacts between patients outside of the group setting and perpetuation of dependency needs as they try to treat each other. Romances or business dealings between group members usually end disastrously because these patients will not be able to use the group objectively to explore the relationship, which is often a continuation of unproductive searches to be cared for. Elaine, a 29-year-old woman, was referred for group therapy after 2 years of individual psychotherapy. The oldest of four daughters, Elaine was sexually abused by her father, starting around age 5 and continuing for over 10 years. She perceived her mother as weak and ineffectual, and her father as demanding and unable to be pleased. In adolescence, she became the caretaker for the whole family. As her sisters married and had children, Elaine remained single, entering college and then graduate school. She had few girlfriends and dated infrequently. Her only romantic relationships involved two married, much older supervisors. Most of her off-work time was devoted to organizing family functions, caring for ill family members, and generally taking care of family problems. Isolated and depressed, Elaine sought individual therapy. Recognizing the limitations in her social functioning, she later requested a referral for group therapy. There, she quickly established a position as the helper for the others, denying any problems of her own. She often became angry with the therapist, whom she perceived as not helpful enough to the group members. The group members encouraged Elaine to examine issues she had previously been unable to confront, her constant scowling and intimidating facial expressions, and her subtly angry verbal exchanges. Although this process took many frustrating months, she was eventually able to acknowledge her disdain for women, which became obvious in the group setting. Elaine realized that her anger at the male therapist was actually transferred anger from her father, and recognized her compulsive attempts to repeat this father-daughter relationship with other men. Elaine began to experiment in the group with new ways of interacting with men and women. Simultaneously, she was able to pull back from the suffocating immersion in her family's problems. Most standardized therapies combine group with individual treatment. Some approaches, such as mentalization-based therapy, MBT, are psychodynamic and exploratory with less direction from the therapist. Others, such as dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, and systems training for emotional predictability and problem solving, STEPS, are more supportive, behavioral, and educational, emphasizing lectures, homework assignments, and advice, as opposed to non-directive interactions. Family therapies.